This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My first guest, Julie Klausner, created, writes, and co-stars in the Hulu comedy series Difficult People. She and Billy Eichner play best friends living in New York who are aspiring comics and failing at becoming famous. They're obsessed with pop culture, and being the difficult people they are, they constantly make hilarious, snarky comments about celebrities, movies, TV shows, and theater, which means they're constantly offending the people they most want to impress. Difficult People started its second season last month. One of its executive producers is Amy Poehler. Julie Klausner also has a podcast called How Was Your Week? She was a co-executive producer and writer for Billy Eichner's series Billy on the Street. She also did some writing for Joan Rivers. And she's obsessed enough with pop culture that she used to be a recapper, writing episode recaps for The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills and New York. Let's start with a scene from the first episode of Difficult People. Julie and Billy are walking into a theater to see a production of the musical Annie.
I love Annie. Isn't it funny how FDR is a total hero in this play, even though in real life he let millions of Jews die?
Hilarious. I love that he was born during a time when handicapped people still had to wear blankets on their laps.
Have you heard from Josh?
Nope. And it's been over a week, and we are done.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Billy.
I'm actually very upset. Josh was so hot.
Yeah.
And not a moron.
Well, if he broke up with you, clearly he is a moron.
By the way, your Real Housewives recap today was hilarious.
Oh,
we were dying.
Thank you. God, I'm so funny when I write mean things about TV shows. How come no one's hired me to write for one?
Because our lives are garbage and it's the world's fault. Ugh. I hate this time of year. My light spring jacket is soaked with both pollen and snow. I wish I never had to go outside.
Well, that's why I've always been an indoors kid. I used to spend every recess in the school library, even when it was beautiful outside.
And that's adorable.
It's Julie Klausner and Billy Eichner in the first episode of Difficult People. Julie Klausner, welcome to Fresh Air. I want to quote something you write in your book. And you write, there's a fantasy I've always entertained about connecting with somebody who hated as much about the world as me. somebody crank and crank contrarian who loved dishing about successful people we both knew. So how did that go?
It went great, Terry. That was basically my intention. I published my vision board, I guess. but in the book, I was talking about a romantic partner and on the show, you know, there very much is a romance between our characters, but we are best friends.
But in real life, have you tried to, like, form relationships based on hating things and based on, like, what you don't like about pop culture or what you don't like about certain celebrities? And how far does that get you? That deep connection through, I don't like it either.
I think it gets you pretty far. But it goes beyond the superficial of what I don't like about celebrities. I think when you connect with someone that has always felt like an outsider or who has not found her tribe yet or is still looking to be heard in a way that she, I keep saying the third person, I'm clearly talking about myself, the way that I didn't feel like I was necessarily heard or understood growing up, then there is a romance to that commiseration. It's a shared experience. So I don't, I don't acknowledge precisely how shallow that sounds. I think that it is rooted in a more simple desire to connect with someone that you have something in common with that's actually pretty deep and emotional and comes from, you know, in some cases, some pretty traumatic childhood experiences.
So one of the words I learned from watching your series is the word participator. I didn't know that this had been named. Would you explain what a participator is?
Well, we named it. Not a real.
Okay, good. I'm glad you named it.
It's not a real term.
It needed a name, so explain it.
A participator is someone who is all too happy to sing along at a concert when someone on stage tells them to, or clap along, or to sing happy birthday when someone in a restaurant is getting a cake.
Someone at another table.
Yeah, it's someone that's very, very eager to be a part of whatever is going on around them, I guess.
When the magician on stage says, "Are there any volunteers?" the participator is the person who raises their hand.
Absolutely. That is exactly. Yes.
So, listen, I live in fear of those kinds of things where you will, against your will, be forced to participate in something. Mm-hmm. When you're mm-hmm. in the audience trying to just, like, watch and listen. So what got you thinking about the participator thing? And thank you again for naming it.
Well, first of all, I want to add that I, too, sit in complete fear when something like that happens. And maybe you're at a concert with a person you don't know very well, and the singer says, "Okay, this side of the room, do this part, and that side of the room, do that part." And I think, "Oh God, is this person going to hate me if I don't do it?" So there's a lot of pressure. And obviously, this is also, take this with a grain of salt, because I loved Cats, and that's the ultimate audience participation nightmare. But, I mean, they don't bring you up on stage, but the cats will touch you, or at least interact with you. I should stop talking about cats. The idea occurred to me because I go to a lot of shows and I don't like singing along when they tell me to. And I'm always fascinated by the people who do and have no self-consciousness about it. And part of it is, well, you know, they're not too cool for school. And I guess that's good. But another part of it, you know, as a performer, I wonder, are these people just not getting the performance time they need? I mean, maybe they should take an improv class, or either way, it was just my way of wrapping my head around something that made me very uncomfortable. So yeah, in season one, Billy dates a participator, and that is sort of the deal breaker.
Okay, so I don't like those participator things because I sing very tunelessly. So it's just like, it's totally embarrassing. So I just maybe will mouth it, mouth the words, but I will not sing. But you have a really nice voice. I've heard you sing. On
Thank
YouTube.
You,
yes. So what's your problem with singing along?
Well, it's a tree falls in the woods, isn't it? The narcissism of a performer. If I can sing well and no one can hear me, what's the point? It's like the difference between, you know, my friend Gaylord once told me the difference between a writer and someone that, you know, writes is someone who writes will tell their friend something. And someone who is a writer, it's not enough to tell their friend something. They need to tell a bunch of strangers so they get that validation. And I am sadly the latter.
Okay.
And also, I just want to add that if you're in the audience of a show, you've signed on, you've paid a price to not do any work.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
one should delight in the passivity of being entertained, I think.
There's also this weird element of, I always feel like in a participator kind of situation, like you are being told by somebody what you're supposed to do. And I just
it's
resist it. You know, like, no, you can't order me to sing. You can't
Absolutely.
Order me to do this. Like, I'm here on my own accord. And like,
yeah.
You're not the boss, you know?
You're not the boss of me. And I will also draw a parallel to people that try to force you to dance at a party.
Yes.
How dare you?
Yes.
How dare you?
I want to play another clip, and this is from the third episode of the first season of Difficult People. And Billy, who's played by Billy Eichner, was going to appear as the bartender on the Bravo talk show Watch What Happens Live. But he's asked to leave because one of the celebrity guests that night, Chelsea Handler, didn't like the fact that Billy had made fun of her on Twitter. So Billy's really depressed about getting thrown out of the show. And he and you go back to your apartment where your boyfriend is also, he's really depressed. And he works on PBS and Pledge Week isn't going well for him. So Billy speaks first.
I was banned from Bravo.
Congratulations.
It's Chelsea Handler's fault.
No, it's my fault too. I need to stop being mean to celebrities. Every time I talk about a famous person, I lose a potential gig.
Talking about celebrities is what we do, okay? It's the only thing that comes more naturally to us than breathing air.
I know, but maybe it's time to pull Perez Hilton.
Pose in a Speedo with a baby in the bathtub?
No, I mean stop being mean to celebrities.
Just as it's starting to pay off? Chelsea Handler knows who you are now. Maybe it's just a question of picking your feuds as your star rises. I'm hungry. Are you hungry, Arthur? Is there dinner?
No, I'm sorry, Noodles. I was just far too spent when I got home. Would you like pizza?
I guess.
Arthur, are you okay?
Oh, yes. Thank you, Billy. And I'm sorry I didn't get up to greet you when you came in. It's just pledge drive week at PBS, and it is even crazier than last year.
Oh, my God, I just got invited to the Simpsons Live at Town Hall after party.
Oh, I didn't get that invitation. Probably because I'm mean to everyone. I bet I said something provocative about Yardley Smith on Instagram at some point.
Is it Yardley or Yeardley?
I don't know.
And an invitation will always be redundant because you will always be my plus one.
Well, thank you.
What am I, flake sandwich meat?
And as far as the whole being nice to celebrities thing, I'm not in favor of it, particularly because Chrissy Teigen just weighed in on the Greek elections.
Oh, well, she doesn't have quite the shrewd political mind of a Naya Rivera. No, I don't want to be mean anymore.
Oh, so that was Billy Eichner and my guest Julie Klausner on an episode of Difficult People, which Julie writes, stars in, and is the executive producer of. So they're so surprised that being nasty to people actually has repercussions. So, but I'm wondering how this has played out in your life. I mean, you're on Twitter all the time. You've done recaps. So when you've said something bad about people, has that ever come back and slapped you in the face?
Yes, but like our characters on the show, I am so amazed every time it happens because in my mind, I am not famous. I am not listened to or paid attention to. And I think our characters on the show believe in their worldview that they're so inconsequential and they're so ignored. Our characters will always use the passive tense because we believe that it's the world's fault and not ours. There's nothing we can do to even that score. But whenever that does happen, there is a certain amount of surprise in the sense of, oh, you were listening? Thank you.
So what's the worst thing that has happened to you as a result of having insulted somebody?
Well, I made a joke on Twitter about Zendaya in regards to her weight. She is a Disney star who is a singer and a model for CoverGirl, I believe, right now. She looked very thin at a Kids' Choice Awards event, and I tweeted something, and she was very upset about it and tweeted a response. And that experience taught me a lot of things about her fan base, about a generation of millennial feminists that consider body type something that is not to be joked about. Even though I grew up thinking, well, if you poke fun at thin, beautiful women, it's okay because this is a society where everyone tells you that you can't be too thin. I came to it thinking that, and I left realizing that that's no longer an acceptable point of view. The stuff I also took from it had to do with just how people's fans online can rally together behind someone that's already famous and doesn't necessarily need their support to pile on to someone on Instagram and say things like, body shaming is wrong, you fat cow. And I...
Did you get that?
I got a lot of it. And I don't like to talk about it because I don't want to make myself seem like a victim of internet bullying because I think that that's a real thing. And I also don't want to make myself seem like a victim because I'm the one who started it. But that was not a fun week as far as Zendaya's fans weighing in, so to speak, on my comments that in retrospect should have been more thought through.
A lot of comics for at least the past couple of years have been complaining that this is a difficult time to be a comic because people have gotten so sensitive that anything that could be interpreted as an insult or as a slight that is politically incorrect, people are all over you about it, and they'll be tweeting about it, and you'll be attacked for it. Some comics have said it's hard to play college campuses. Since your specialty in some ways, at least on Difficult People, is the insult and the insult of people who are famous as well as ones who aren't. How are you dealing with that in a time when everybody is really sensitive?
It's tough because I want to be a good guy It's tough because I want to be on the right side of things. A lot of comedians don't care.
You want to insult everybody and be loved for it.
Well, yes. I mean, do we want to get into that? How I want to be loved by absolutely everyone, even though it's shocking to me that I'm loved by anyone. That's something I discuss at length with my therapist. But the truth of it is that I want to be the person that knows when it's okay to make fun of someone because they're more powerful than you. And that's what I thought I was, that's where I thought I was coming from. And I learned that that is not necessarily how people see it. I have no problem with the insult or the attack. I don't want to be a bully. I want to be a vigilante, I guess. I want to be a person that points out hypocrisies and that shows that this is a world in which beauty standards for women are unrealistic and offensive. And we live in a world in which if a woman loses a lot of weight and she sees people she hasn't seen in a long time, they will be way more effusive and complimentary and congratulatory and excited than if she had just gotten her PhD. And I was coming from a place that I don't think was, I don't even want to say it was misinterpreted. I just don't think people agreed with. And I now know that, and it's good to know it. And I'll make all decisions about what jokes I do and don't make going forward based on what I know, not based on what people tell me is okay, but just knowing that there are people that say, you know, body weight is off limits. That said, do I agree with them when they say it's just as bad to make fun of a woman for being too thin as it is to make fun of a woman for being too fat? Absolutely not. That's not a world in which I live.
Okay, so you often write kind of snarky tweets and then people can be like ultra snarky in their response to you. But now you have a TV series and the reviews I've read have been really positive. I'm sure somebody's written a negative review. How are you at dealing with a negative review of work that you really put a lot of time into? It's not just like a slap back after a tweet.
It depends on who it's coming from. If it's from someone who is intelligent and who has a lot of things to say that make a lot of sense, I will take that criticism to heart. I listen to people who I respect when they say things, whether or not they're positive or negative towards me or my work.
I guess what I'm really asking is, are there people who say to you, you can dish it out, but you can't take it?
I think I'm getting better at taking it every day. I think the internet is a marvelous and horrible numbing device. And as I mentioned, I'm doing my best to, I don't want to say stay off social media, because God forbid I'd be one of those people that says, hey, everybody, I'm not going to be on Facebook for a month. And you're like, you didn't need to say that. You could have just, anyway, I'm not making a thing about being unplugged is what I'm saying. But my friend Tom Sharpling had a very good point about the idea of how easy it is to tweet something and get the feedback that creative people naturally crave. It's why we do what we do, and feel as though you have accomplished something in the way that if you worked on a book or a script or something that takes a lot longer than it does to compose a tweet, you would get that kind of feedback. I think Tom was right when he pointed out that social media has the benefits of that without the hard work. And because I do have a TV show, I need to be a lot better at saving up stuff that I think and making it and fictionalizing it or dramatizing it and using the amazing platform I have to express it in more than 140 characters and ideally more artfully and with more context.
So I want to talk a little bit about casting difficult people. It's a very representative cast. I mean, you have black actors and white actors, gay actors and straight actors, thin actors and heavy actors, a trans actor. And a great actor who should be better known than he is, who I don't know what other categories he fits into, but that, you know, that one would be James Urbaniak. Did you set about trying to make like a very representative cast and to have very, like, you know, diverse characters?
Absolutely. It was never something that was imposed on us or an afterthought. It was just part of the fabric of the world that we wanted to show. And we also wanted to show how trans people can be jerks too. That, you know, there's a whole range of people in New York City, in our world. You know, Billy and Julie aren't the only difficult people. The people around them are pretty awful too, or at least difficult. And I think an important part of inclusiveness and diversity in TV and film has to do with writing characters that are not, you know, perfect or
role
idealistic
models.
Or yeah. Exactly, yeah. And Shekina Nafak, who plays Lola, is so irreverent and hilarious, and she was so excited at the idea of playing a trans character that doesn't get killed or isn't a magical, perfect presence. And we got to do things with her character, like comments on the misinterpretation of who she is. Cole Escola's character, Matthew, is a sort of effeminate theater fanatic who works with Billy at the cafe as a waiter. And he treats Shekina's character like a drag queen and says things like, "Yes, honey." And Lola has to remind him that she's not a drag queen and shuts him down. And that stuff, I've never seen it before. You know, some of the diversity is political, but a lot of it just comes from the fact that, you know, a big challenge of writing is, well, have I seen that before? And would I like to see that?
So I was thinking I'd maybe end the interview the same way I ended my interview with Don Rickles. And this is a question that I've only ever asked Don Rickles, but I think I'll ask it to you too, and I may regret it. But fortunately, we edit the show, so if I don't like the answer, we can just take it out. So the question is, would you insult me?
Not for $1 million.
Ah, oh, come on.
I love you so much, Terry. Can I insult you? I really don't know if I can.
Okay.
I just,
all right.
There,
I don't want to put you on
know,
the spot.
Like,
I thought it would come
no,
naturally.
I wouldn't hear, I wouldn't insult you. I wouldn't insult, you know, Madonna. There's certain people that I am often mentioned
in the same sentence as her. It happens to me all the time.
You're more self-aware about your singing. I'll say that. Oh, I just did insult Madonna. No, I just couldn't do it. I couldn't do that. I couldn't insult you. I'm not going to insult my dad. Certain people that are off limits.
Oh, okay. Julie Klausner, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh my God, Terry, thank you so much for having me.
Julie Klausner created, writes, and stars in the Hulu comedy series Difficult People. The show is currently in season 2. The new film comedy War Dogs takes a new angle on America's wars in the wake of 9/11. It's directed by Todd Phillips, who's best known for The Hangover, and it stars Jonah Hill and Miles Teller as two unlikely arms dealers. Our critic at large, John Powers, says the movie's at its best when its characters are at their worst.
War may be hell, but it can be heaven for business. That's why, for as long as there have been wars, there have always been people eager to make money from them. What makes America special is that the profits to be made are astronomical. This reality forms the backdrop of Todd Phillips' jauntily enjoyable new comedy, War Dogs, just the latest movie to take it for granted, along with the majority of Americans, that our wars in Afghanistan and Iraq have been a real mess. Freely adapted from a 2011 Rolling Stone article by Guy Lawson, it tells the basically true story of two 20-something Miami dudes who become international arms dealers. The year is 2005, and Whiplash's Miles Teller is David Pakuz. A decent enough guy with a nice girlfriend is, played by Ana de Armas, and a part-time job as a massage therapist. David is going nowhere until he bumps into his old Hebrew school buddy Ephraim Divaroli. That's Jonah Hill, a sleazy, out-of-control braggart who's making big money selling weapons. How's that possible? Well, after the Bush administration was accused of cronyism in supplying American troops, notably in its no-bid contracts with Vice President Cheney's old company Halliburton, the Defense Department opened up the bidding process to everyone. In today's increasingly privatized military, there was so much money being spent in so many directions that the small fry could make a fortune picking up the crumbs too small for the sharks. That's just what Ephraim does. And he invites his gullible friend to join him. Although David has to lie about his job to his anti-war girlfriend, he signs on, seduced by Ephraim's drugs, manic energy, and the chance to score big. At first, their transactions are perfectly legal. But the two soon become involved in ever bigger and dodgier ventures, delivering a truckload of pistols to U.S. soldiers in Baghdad, and going into business with Bradley Cooper's character, a major league arms dealer on the U.S. terrorist watch list, who can provide Soviet-made ammo located in Albania that they can then ship to Afghanistan. A deal worth millions. Here, Ephraim tries to convince the reluctant David that this is the smart move.
We're talking exclusive access to a stockpile of Soviet bloc non-standard weapons and ammo. That's gonna win this deal for us.
He's on a terrorist watch list.
Whatever, people end up on that list for bringing scissors onto an airplane.
That's not why he's on the list.
Look, the Pentagon wants 100 million rounds of AK-47 ammo in the middle of a worldwide shortage. Where do you think they think that's gonna come from? A bunch of shady motherfuckers like that guy. This is the job, to do business with the people in places the U.S. government can't do business with directly. It's as simple as that.
Needless to say, it isn't as simple as that. Things start to go very wrong. In fact, War Dogs belongs to the mini tradition of rise and fall stories launched by Goodfellas, deepened by Boogie Nights, and jocularized by The Wolf of Wall Street. It eventually turns into a morality tale about making deals with the devil, then lying to oneself and to others about it. Of course, the problem with such tales is that the immoral rise is usually more fun to watch than the day of reckoning. Although this is easily Phillips's most ambitious film, yes, even more ambitious than The Hangover Part 3, he remains a specialist in laddishness. War Dogs comes most alive when David and Ephraim are gleefully scrolling down lists of potential contracts, smuggling guns into Iraq from Jordan with a 50-50 chance of being killed, or getting high, in every sense, from their profits. The movie's less successful with quieter, more serious matters. While it's not surprising that De Armas's role is thankless, Phillips has never demonstrated any discernible interest in women as human beings, David himself has surprisingly little to do. Teller is a terrific young actor, yet his character is so generic that his moral qualms get eclipsed by Hill's movie star performance. It's like watching Jeb Bush in those debates with Donald Trump. Indeed, with his puffed-up chin, Scarface poster, and hip-hop swagger, he loves firing Uzis. The psychopathic Ephraim dominates the screen with his dark brio, like some particularly poisonous frog you might see in a National Geographic special. But if Hill is the most vivid thing about War Dogs, the most important is what it actually shows about how America spends its money and makes its wars. The notion that hustlers like Ephraim and David might actually be supplying our troops, with bullets recycled from Eastern Europe, may sound like something from an agitprop black comedy by some Hollywood liberal. Yet it actually happened. It turns out that life isn't merely stranger than fiction. It's also more satirical.
John Powers writes about film and TV for Vogue and Vogue.com. He reviewed the film War Dogs. You may think you know who you are, but you don't really, unless you're aware of the fact that there are trillions of microbes living on and in you. They affect your digestion, immunity, body weight, and overall health. Scientists are researching what those microbes do and how we might be able to improve our health by manipulating the balance of those microbes. The ecosystem of microbes within humans and animals is the subject of the new book, I Contain Multitudes, by science writer Ed Yong. He writes about science for The Atlantic and writes a science blog hosted by National Geographic called Not Exactly Rocket Science. Ed Yong, welcome to Fresh Air. So as you say, our body is really an ecosystem. What are some of the different communities of microbes on and in our bodies?
Well, there are tens of trillions of them altogether, but they vary from one part to the other because, for example, my forearm is quite a dry environment like a desert, whereas something like my mouth or the inside of my nose is a hot and humid environment that's more like a rainforest. And each of these places harbors a very different community of microbes.
And a lot of those bacteria, a lot of those microbes are good guys, helping your body do what it needs to do. But as you point out, if one of the good guy bacteria gets into the wrong spot, it becomes a bad guy.
That's right. We've had this long-standing idea that microbes are our germs, our enemies that we need to destroy lest they destroy us. But actually, we're coming to realize that many of these microbes are profoundly important for our lives. But there isn't really any such thing as a good microbe or a bad microbe. They just live with us. They are our partners in life, and they can often do us tremendous amounts of good. They can help to digest our food and tune our immune system and protect us from disease. But if they get in the wrong place or if our relationship with them breaks down, then they might also do us harm.
I want to talk with you about probiotics. So many people take probiotics in the hopes of having a healthy gut. And among scientists who actually study the microbiome, which is the microbes living in the gut, it's actually pretty controversial whether probiotics accomplish anything. So let's start with, what are probiotics supposed to do?
So probiotics are products that contain beneficial microbes, and they have all sorts of health claims attached to them. But actually, if you look at the evidence behind these products, they tend to be a bit medically underwhelming. So they're good for certain types of infectious diarrhea, but not a huge amount else. And even regulators in the US and in Europe have taken a dim view of many of these health claims. And I think that's because probiotics contain typically small numbers of microbes, much fewer than already exist in your body. A lot of these species are being chosen for historical reasons, because they're easy to manufacture and package, not because they're excellent at establishing themselves in the gut. And often they're very industrialized, very proprietary strains. You know, they enter and then they disappear or they pass through. They don't have a huge amount of impact. And yet the idea behind probiotics, the idea that we might be able to give ourselves beneficial bacteria that improve our health, that idea has a lot of potential and it is solid, but we are still in the very early stages of working out how to do this. It is about engineering an entire ecosystem. It's as complicated as changing a coral reef or a grassland. It's about sculpting a world.
So when we take a probiotic that we bought in a store, are the bacteria in that probiotic likely to repopulate in our gut?
No, they're not. Typically, they don't manage to establish themselves and they don't last for a long time. So they're not very good colonizers.
And are they microbes that typically live in our gut?
They're microbes that can be found in the gut, but they're not the A-listers. They're not the ones that are especially common or especially good at colonizing the gut.
What about yogurt, which usually has active cultures in it, probiotic cultures?
Same thing. Studies have shown that you swallow them and those bacteria then disappear. I think of them as like a breeze that blows between two open windows. It might rattle a couple of objects in the way, but it doesn't have a lasting impact.
You're depressing me.
Sorry.
Okay. When you take antibiotics, the antibiotics kill off a lot of the bacteria in your body, including ones that you would prefer to have. And some of those bacteria that you'd prefer to have live in your gut. And I think that's at least one of the reasons why taking antibiotics can lead to diarrhea, because it kills off some of the bacteria that keeps your gut in balance. And that's usually a time when even doctors who don't especially believe in probiotics still recommend that you take it. So what's the common wisdom now among scientists who are actually studying this about the value of taking probiotics as an antidote to antibiotics?
Well, so some types of antibiotic-associated diarrhea involve this very nasty, weedy bacterium called Clostridium difficile, or C. diff, which is very good at invading guts that have been repeatedly assaulted with antibiotics and can cause recurring, intractable cases of diarrhea. And actually, one of the best treatments for C. diff, and in fact, one of the most successful microbiome-based treatments we have, is a thing called a fecal transplant. A fecal transplant is almost exactly what it sounds like. You're trying to take the stool from a healthy donor and implant it into the gut of someone who's sick. And you are doing that almost as a way of resetting their inner ecosystem, of replacing a community that has been faltering, much like trying to re-turf a lawn that's been overrun with dandelions or other weeds.
And how is that being done now? It's been in its experimental stages, but I think they're kind of perfecting ways of doing it without it being as gross as it sounds.
Mm-hmm. So the traditional way is to use actual stool, and it can be delivered either up the bum or down the nose via a tube. And, you know, it does have this ick factor attached to it, but it is also spectacularly effective at treating infections of Clostridium difficile, C. diff. In one classic study, some 27% of people who took a common antibiotic were cured of C. diff infections, whereas those who received fecal transplant, about 94% of them were cured. So we're in this weird position where the number one treatment for C. diff is a number two. And fecal transplants have done wonders for this particular condition. Whether it works for other diseases, so following the successes with C. diff, scientists and doctors have tried fecal transplants for a large number of other conditions that have been linked to the microbiomes, things like inflammatory bowel disease or irritable bowel syndrome. And there the results are certainly less successful, a bit less consistent. And that's probably because those types of diseases, those ecosystems inside us, are more difficult to reset. So other researchers are now trying to take the concept behind fecal transplants and refine it to pull out the bacteria and other microbes that are conferring the benefits to the recipients without having to bother with the gross fecal bit. So several companies have developed pills that are, you could think of them either as like pared down stool or souped up probiotics, right? So they are communities of microbes that are meant to replicate a lot of the benefits of a donor stool.
So why is it that a fecal transplant might be more effective than a probiotic pill?
So there you're using a much wider community of microbes and you are giving them in large numbers and you're using the ones that are naturally there in the gut anyway. So it's a much more realistic community to implant in a person. But you know, the real answer to this question is we still don't entirely know. We don't really know which components of stool, which members of that community are really doing good, how they might interact with the native microbes in a recipient's gut or with the gut itself, with the immune system of the host. There are still so many questions that we have left to answer. All we know is that for this one particular condition, C. diff infections, it seems to be a very, very good treatment with few known side effects, if any, and that's very cheap.
Microbes can contribute to our immune system. And you describe how microbes can trigger inflammation and microbes can also suppress inflammation. Can mm-hmm. you give us a sense of the interplay between those two sets of microbes and how they regulate our immune system for better and for worse?
Right. So we typically think of the immune system as this militaristic force that defends us from the microbes in the world around us. And yet we see that certain types of microbes help to build parts of the immune system, and then they also calibrate it. So they strike this balance between reacting, between protecting ourselves from infections, but also not overreacting. So they help, some species help to stop the immune system from going berserk at harmless things in our environment, like pollen or dust, things that might trigger allergies. And that balance between inflammation and anti-inflammation is very much affected by our microbes. They set that tipping point, much like the thermostat in my house might control the temperature of a room and keep it stable.
So when it comes to microbiome research, it seems like we're still kind of in the infancy of it. We know enough to know this is a really promising field. We might learn a lot about foods to eat and not need eat, about things to expose ourselves and not to expose ourselves to. We might find new cures for autoimmune diseases. But right now, it seems like it's still in the formative stages, very experimental.
Yeah, very much so. We've known about microbes for over 350 years, but the science of the human microbiome has really only taken off in the last decade or so. And there's so much we don't know. We don't still have a full catalogue of the species that live inside us. We still don't really understand what makes my microbiome different to yours, what explains those variations between people, much less what a good microbiome looks like or how you might get to that stage. But I think the potential there is huge because the microbiome is theoretically very flexible. We should be able to change it. We just don't quite know how yet. And maybe one of the quicker wins with microbiome science might be to use the microbiome as a sort of diagnostic tool of looking at it and say what you're more likely to develop this disease or that disorder, or to use it to influence our treatment. So we know that microbes within us affect how well medicines work in our body. We know that a lot of different drugs, from the hottest new cancer immunotherapy drugs to obvious things like acetaminophen, can work in some people and not in others because of which microbes they carry.
Not everybody has a favorite microbe, but you do.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us
yes.
tell us what it is.
I do. It is called Wolbachia. It was discovered in 1924, and it was found inside a common brown mosquito by two scientists, Hertig and Wolbach. And for decades, no one knew what it did, how common it was, whether it was important. It was largely neglected. And then scientists realized that actually it's incredibly common. It's not found in humans, but it is found in some 4 in 10 species of insects and other arthropods, which are themselves the most numerous and most diverse animals on the planet. So Wolbachia is extraordinarily successful. And it does all sorts of incredible things. So in some hosts, it is a parasite that has a thing out for males, because Wolbachia only passes down from mothers to daughters, and so males are a complete dead end to it. In some species, like wood lice, it converts males into females. In others, it kills males outright, so that the females outnumber males by 100 to 1. And in some wasps, Wolbachia allows them to reproduce by cloning themselves. So they have no need for males whatsoever. But in some cases, this thing is also an ally. It is a mutualist. It allows some caterpillars that eat leaves to stop the leaves from turning yellow. It actually holds back the progress of fall so that its hosts can have more to eat. And it has properties that are really important to us humans. So Wolbachia is found in parasitic worms that cause debilitating tropical diseases like elephantiasis and river blindness. And by finding drugs that can kill Wolbachia, scientists are finally looking for and discovering effective ways of curing and treating these illnesses.
What about mosquito-borne diseases like dengue and Zika? There seems to be some relevance there, too.
That's right. Wolbachia turns out to be a really powerful way of controlling mosquito-borne diseases. So scientists in Australia have spent about 25 years trying to load this bacterium into Aedes aegypti, the tiger mosquito, the one that spreads dengue and yellow fever and infamously now Zika. And they've been trying to do this because Wolbachia seems to prevent these insects from transmitting the viruses behind these diseases. And Wolbachia is so good at spreading through a wild population that if you release a small number of these infected mosquitoes, they ought to fly off into the distance. And then within months, Wolbachia should be everywhere, thus rendering this entire community of insects unable to spread disease. The bacterium changes them from vectors into dead ends. And this was tried for the first time in 2011 in several suburbs of Australia. This team showed indeed that Wolbachia rises to dominance in these natural populations. And they're now trying this approach in big megacities around the world, in places like Brazil and Colombia and Indonesia and Vietnam. And there are so
places
many
with mosquito issues.
Places with mosquito issues, places with severe dengue problems. Mm-hmm. The approach was initially developed in order to eliminate dengue fever, but it seems to work against Zika as well, against a lot of other mosquito-borne diseases. And it has tremendous advantages. Unlike, say, insecticides, which are toxic and need to be continuously resprayed, Wolbachia in these mosquitoes seems to have no problems, no safety risks, and it sustains itself. Once you release the insects, they go off in their business, and you don't need to keep on replenishing them.
So you're not messing with the mosquito's genetics. You're introducing a bacteria?
That's right. There is no genetic modification. These mosquitoes are not GMOs to speak of. They've been simply united with a bacterium that is already present in a large proportion of other insects.
Ed Yong, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Ed Yong's new book is called I Contain Multitudes, The Microbes Within Us and a Grander View of Life. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Thea Chaloner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. I'm Terry Gross.